Okay, good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are, as everywhere else in the world, nearing the end of our summer season this morning, and we are also nearing the end of our summer program here in Philadelphia. So we'll start with the announcements and then explain why, in terms of the declaration, why we do what we do. The program for the summer, ending next Sunday, has been an overview of self-development. And during July and September, we looked at a variety of articles by HPB and William Q. Judge that dealt with different observations, if you will, on the topic of self-development. So today and next Sunday, which is the last Sunday of the cycle, we'll be looking at an article entitled Musings on the True Theosophist's Path. We're doing part one today, part two next Sunday. The building opens at 10:30 on Sunday mornings, and this meeting starts, as this morning, promptly at 11. Before and after the Sunday meetings, if you wish to purchase materials for home study, you can do so at the book table. They are offered at cost. And also, if you pick up the periodical that's available in the foyer, you will have access to our website as well, where there are links that you could get the literature for free on the internet. Also available, if you've not noticed, is the new periodical for the coming quarter, which will start in October. And that little periodical for October, November, and December is now available. The October theme for Sundays is going to be Theosophy and the Theosophical Movement, a good introduction to what we're about. Wednesday evenings, we're also winding down the summer cycle. For the last 3 months ending now, we've been looking at the Bhagavad Gita, world-renowned treatise, an ancient and incredible source on Eastern psychology. And that study will come to a conclusion this coming Wednesday night. During the winter cycle that starts in October, the Wednesday night study classes will feature a collation of articles by William Q. Judge dating from the late 19th century, and the little book that we're using is called The Ocean of Theosophy. Wednesdays, the building opens at 5:30. There is a reference library available with an associate there to help guide individual study. And that library stays open from 5:30 to 7:30. The Wednesday night study class, either the Gita this coming Wednesday or the Ocean the following Wednesday, that study class will start promptly at 7:45 and will last until 9. And again, before and after the Wednesday night class, there's ample time if you want to make a purchase for home use or you want to talk to somebody about how to use the internet to get the literature. All of the activities that I've just described, all the changes with the seasons, et cetera, are actually just a reflection of a universal statement that was pulled together in the early 20th century. And this declaration, the statement of declared purpose, is something that does not change with the seasons. It is universally found throughout the world in any United Lodge of Theosophists that you might visit. Anyone who is associated with the United Lodge of Theosophists would hearken back to the declared purposes as their guideline for their work at the Theosophical Movement. However, this lodge and all other lodges holding this declaration in common are really not organized together in any way. Each is an autonomous, independently devoted to the cause association of free thinkers and students who are loyal to the great founders of the movement. They're extremely loyal to the philosophy, both an exploration of the philosophy, an application of the philosophy, and a dissemination of the philosophy. And you won't find in any ULT any constitution, officers, bylaws, no political or personal shenanigans with organization. You will not find any side issues of any kind. Rather, the facility is kept open specifically for the study and application of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy. And the ultimate, the basis for everything that is so universal and so sacred is the notion of universal brotherhood. So you will find that this appeals to individuals who really want to understand the nature of the human beast, the nature of the true self, and how to altruistically move from a philosophy into an applied philosophy, if you will. So all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without any kind of distinction as to condition of personality, body, interest, everyone is welcome to come in and join in the effort to promote the study of the philosophy and the application of the philosophy. And those who do visit and then remain are very hopeful on the basis of their efforts of to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. You can find an eloquent, magnificent statement of that declaration on the back of any of the periodical brochures, whether you still have one for the summer ending this week or whether you've picked one up for the autumn, October, November, and December. You'll find that declaration on the back. So, without further avail, this morning's effort to study together, to assimilate what we're studying, and to apply it in that development of self along that same thematic basis, is the first half of an article entitled Musings on the True Theosophist's Path. And so we'll have a summation of that article. Actually, we're having a summary of certain paragraphs, but the entire first half of the article and a bit of the second is available for discussion this morning.
Can you hear me?
Okay. No.
Is this better? Is that better?
Shell.
Yes.
Okay. Just to start off, we're kind of looking at the process that we have to go through to find inward peace. And he says that there's really no instance where some kind of effort is not being put forth, that everything that we do requires some kind of effort. And with that effort, there is, as he puts it, a natural result. And that he who would be searching for spiritual knowledge has to continually put forth an effort. But that effort is not to separate oneself from everyone else. That just because this person may have more of this knowledge does not mean that he is any better than anybody else. And we love the first sentence in this paragraph. The next paragraph says, the soul develops like the flower in God's sunlight and unconsciously to the soil in which it grows. It's just a wonderful analogy. So if that light is shut out and the soil becomes spoiled, then that flower is going to die. So we can liken this to our soul, that if we don't continually nourish it, that it will wither and die as well. And that everyone is here for a reason. If we only find out partially why we are here, then that is more reason for us to become more attached to life in general, to seek in it the further elucidation of the problem. It is not the study of ourselves so much as the thought for others. So everything that we're doing along this path is not, motive should not be for us to grow and be better than anybody else, but to have that knowledge to help others. And he speaks of the mystic and how this person, because they've reached a certain part of their lives, of their path, does not mean that he can just kind of sit back and say, look how wonderful I am. It actually makes his life more complicated, but he should always be doing it with smiling face and joyful heart. So he's basically doing his duty of what it is that comes to him, and once he has progressed, he needs to share with others. So when we're looking at this idea of, as he puts it, obtaining a portion of occult knowledge, it doesn't mean that one withdraws from the rest of mankind. And it actually forces that one to actually go forth and meet other people and guide them on their way as well. That obtaining this knowledge is no excuse to withdraw from the world. And we're looking at the idea of like Buddha's middle way, desiring neither notice, fame, or wealth. And we should actually be looking for anonymous. That we shouldn't be sitting in seclusion and just studying and meditating. We need to go out and be with others. And we would like to read the last sentence. It says, remember, and we thought this was a good example of the pairs of opposites. Remember that thou mayest look for silence in tumult, solitude in company, light in darkness, forgetfulness in pressures, vigor in despondency, courage in fear, resistance in temptation, peace in war, and quiet in tribulation.
Thank you. So here we have the first half of an article by a remarkable soul. And it's a very interesting scenario in that these are musings. These are a series of notions that can be read as an article, or each one of the paragraphs can be lifted, each one of the themes can be lifted for individual study or application at any time. And one of the curious things about the article is the title, Musings on the True Theosophist's Path. What kind of ideas came to you as you thought about the concept of a true theosophist? Yes.
Constant effort.
Constant effort. Okay. Absolute dedication, constant effort. Yes?
Well, we think one can be true to the study and the effort and fail a great deal of the time. And that effort then should be find out what went wrong as best you can. So it doesn't mean it's always successful to be true.
It doesn't mean that the effort, this ongoing effort to be a theosophist, is a flawless process. It doesn't mean that there's a destination, does it? It's this, try something out, you may fail, oh well, observe what you can, learn what you can, and then move on. Yeah.
Also, I think in that idea of the true theosophist, the true theosophist is not one who just merely studies, but applies. And the most important application may be altruism or brotherhood. That's the definition of the true theosophist. Mm-hmm.
So the true theosophist, any soul in any incarnation, an inquirer, a seeker, might come to the philosophy and begin studying the pages the way we used to in, a school situation, you know, memorizing, looking at things, trying to be rational, orderly in our consideration of it. But that book study is one thing. The true theosophy picks up the book study and says, okay, that I've begun to see that there might be three fundamentals. How does that work? And then instead of just a head application, it becomes the heartfelt, oh, wait a minute, if I apply this, how can I help somebody else? Or how is this universal and how is this for everyone? You have a follow-up to what you said?
Follow-up on the title?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We think that word musings is significant, too. It's a kind of meditation, but it's not a deep spiritual or a deep philosophical meditation in that sense. But a musing is more just like some light theme, a very practical theme that mm-hmm. you just keep in your mind and you dwell on every day. And so these things are not meant to be very philosophically profound, but things that we can carry with us any time of the day or think about while we're performing.
Yeah. A musing is the fruit maybe of an awareness as opposed to the fruit of something like a dream in deep sleep or a meditative exploration. Yeah?
Well, one of the sentences that was brought out was that to be filled with theosophy or a true theosophist is filled with happiness and joy. And I think it has a lot to do with this last comment. That our heart becomes open and we begin to see the pain and suffering all around us and in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But we find happiness and joy in knowing these ideas.
Happiness, joy, serenity. That opening line that we did not present today in summation, the way of inward peace, whether you see that as happiness or joy or serenity, contentment, the way of inward peace is in all things to conform to the pleasure and disposition of the divine will. So ultimately, that joyful, lighthearted musing, the awareness of life as an experience, brings with it this gradual effort to align heart and will to something greater than just the little personality. Yeah.
Well, what about that person who doesn't know theosophy but leads a very pure life, works for others, you know, tries to be a good person, have right motives?
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to have, they may not have all these, they may not be aware that all these writings are out there, but can they be looked at as being a true theosophist?
You know, that's an excellent, excellent question. In our declaration, part of that statement, right toward the end, the United Lodge of Theosophists, regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. So as we begin to open ourselves to the company of others. As we become more and more aware of experiencing vicariously ethics in action or the lighthearted service to others, that's going to crop up. We're going to become more and more aware of that in the general population, in the lower kingdoms, in every aspect of life. And we're reminded in the Declaration that just because we have contained our concept of the philosophy to the United Lodge of Theosophy, to the literature that we share, does not mean that these eternal truths, in fact, radiate and bubble up in all sorts of ways, in all sorts of people, and we see it in times of stress, we see it in times of happiness, pure-heartedness, a notion of living life according to a concept of what it is to be divine. If it's universally potential in each and all, we're going to find it in company and companions everywhere and at all times. Yeah?
That last part of the last paragraph that was read, you remember that down the last book, The Silence and Tumult, to the end, really gave us trouble. We understood these are pairs of opposites. My question would be, is the dark side of each of these the attachment we hold? And is the light side that joy and happy to have the work that we talked about earlier? Finding solitude in company, light in darkness, forgetfulness and pressures, it is a tough understanding, at least for us.
There are other articles in the philosophy, among them articles written by B.P. Wadia. And there's a series of articles that were very helpful to put the two things together. True Self-Expression by B.P. Wadia is one such article. And as part of that article, he wrote, "We should so live and act, so love and labor, that every experience is perceived by our inner ruler and is forthwith assimilated by him. All our experiences ought to be flowers from which the bee sucks the honey of knowledge and stores it away for feeding in sweetness and in strength the hungry and the weak." So that last article in this Musings, we are going to be faced in our lives, because it's the nature of experiencing life, the personalities we live through, the bodies we live through, the families we live in, all of these scenarios are potential experiences from which we can learn, assimilate, and grow as soul. And if we are in turmoil, there's a tremendous upsetment going on in the world, in our family, in our desk at work, wherever it happens to be, on the bus, whatever, we can, by nature, retreat from that upsetment and find silence within, peace within. We can observe, we can step back. If we are in a social scenario that seems overwhelming, it's just too many people and too much noise, we can step back from that and peacefully find solitude. We can retreat from the world of senses, and we do this all the time. Well, all of the experience of life, no matter how painful, no matter how exhilarating, we can find a middle ground, a stance, a path that's inner, that's neither high nor low, neither pleasurable nor painful, but it's just an awareness of I am and I'm experiencing. Yeah.
What was the name of
true self-expression. And the quote that I read about the honeybee and, and the assimilation is on page 50. Frankly, I got this off the internet. I'm not sure what book it came out of. Okay, yes.
Once again, with that last sentence, whereas it's clear in this article that study is not enough, cult knowledge, given what it means to be a true theosophist, it would seem, though, that it'd be very difficult to fulfill that last sentence unless we had a certain bit of cult knowledge. And we're wondering if the key to that is knowledge that of the duality of the mind, that the mind being dual can be turned in one direction or another. It's not a matter of blind faith, but a matter of knowing how to direct your own awareness and mind in one direction.
The duality that we experience in life, angel or devil, where's the human being? Well, there is mind or soul, there is self. And in another article by Wadia, the explanation is given, or you can find it for yourself in the key, page 170, 71 to about 175 or 76, right? In the key, there are these terms given, designations given for what we see as duality. The highest eternal expression of spirit as soul in the human kingdom, and then the gradations of the powers or the aspects of soul or mind. And again, it feels like a duality depending on how we're focused as soul, whether we're focused on an eternal idea and the notion of I, or whether we're totally engrossed and enmeshed in that personal, self-centered kind of lower mind, we call it. And along that way, there's another Wadia statement that will sound similar to something that was said earlier in the class about apparent failures. The overcoming of the defects born of personal and environmental knowledge, and the development which brings perception of the traps which ensnare the ego being that self, that eternal self, by a disregard of the true philosophy of universal brotherhood, these cause the God in us to become our guide and friend. The master within is patient to wait and watch for the awakening of the personal man, and compassionate to warn, to encourage and guide him, once the personal man accepts the master as the inner ruler. So what might at first seem like a really ugly, negative aspect of a personal life, I'm living in and through a body and a brain and a personality that, whoa, look at that trait. The awareness of that and the gradual, but I'm soul and I can refocus that, I can transmute it and offer it up. That process, that path of doing that, is what aligns and brings cohesion, if you will, of the head and the heart, or the higher mind and the lower mind, however you want to try to think of it for yourself. Yeah.
What? It talks about a mystic. Sure, the philosophical idea of what mystic is.
I'm chuckling because it's one of the things I circled. You know, are all students of ULT mystics?
Well,
yes.
Isn't the mystic one who thinks with the heart and feels with the mind?
Ah, thinks with the heart and feels with the mind. So there's an assimilation of head and heart, of mind and compassion, not feelings like, you know, the mundane emotions that the senses trigger in the physical, but the intuition. Yeah.
If follow up with that mission-linguistic idea. On the second page, middle paragraph, that ends with these words, "And with your cheering word, if you have no more, the mystic has little else. Strive to lighten the burden for some struggling about." Well, why would the mystic have little more than just the cheering word? Couldn't they go out and do a lot of physical work, or make donations, or be able to, why would it implicate that the mystic would have little more than just the cheering word?
If we premise that the mystic is the student whose heartfelt effort has gone beyond book learning and beyond the logic and critical analysis and has now gone into applications of how and when to help the other. When is there a duty? Because that whole paragraph is about meeting all men not only halfway, but more than that, to seek them. Right? We're in the world. We see all comers. We are in a impersonal kind of a way, friendly to all. But the true mystic is going to know there are karmic limits to what can be done. If we think of the little tiny chick trying to get out of its egg, if the farmer cracks open that egg, that little chick is not going to make it. If the farmer sets up a scenario where the egg is kept in a basket under a light and allows time to pass so that the little chick can peck through its egg and gradually get out of the egg on its own, building the ability to breathe and the muscles to move and the drying out process for its feathers and whatnot, that little chick's in good shape. So a mystic who is trying to empower the other, is trying to hold out help to the other, is trying to say, you know, there is a source of energy, there is a way to live through this, may be able to offer a couple of words or a little bit of observation and then stand back and let the other face karma and grow on their own. There's no vicarious atonement.
As to having little, the mystic doesn't see it that way because their value system is completely different from the world's. What they value is experience, knowledge, opportunities, and wisdom. So they're wealthier than most people, but most people wouldn't see it that way.
And it's fun in the public world to see the contrast between the sophisticated, wealthy, materialistically flamboyant, I guess would be the better way, the conspicuous consumption people. You see them in contrast to the workers, the servants, the folks that are employed by them. And when you stand back and watch the interaction, frequently you will see these folks of high social prestige and apparent physical wealth greatly leaning on the wisdom, the compassion, the heartfelt support in troubled times of very simple folks that are living close to the earth who really don't have material wealth but have an incredible spiritual font from which to draw in troubled times. Yeah.
Everyone knows about the Philadelphia Inquirer newspaper. And we often wonder why it was called an Inquirer. Was it referring to the document? Or was it referring to those who were seeking answers to questions? Because in the library, there are always table.
word inquirer, it's like the chicken and the egg, isn't it? The seeker is often used, or a student, that word is often used, where these musings that are kind of a lifelong process of trying to set a tone in the moment and moving joyfully through the moment, and trying to experience but observe at the same time, that kind of reflection, and the kind of seeking and searching that's done, what comes to mind is that's all a process. This doesn't say musings on the true theosophist's destination or the true theosophist's perfection. The title is Musings on the True Theosophist's Path. The inquiry, the seeking, the musing is ongoing. It becomes a lifestyle in itself. And very gradually, and we know this to be true, we can ask one particular question, gee, I want to know about this in the newspaper. And the next thing you know, you've got a series of questions. And the next thing you know, you've got, as you begin to learn more about a subject matter, now all of a sudden you've got different levels of questions. And that's the same process that the true student who's moved beyond books and is now also working to assimilate the books with life experience, with an idea of helping and being able to be a guidepost for the answers. It's an ongoing process. Yeah?
We were thinking perhaps one of our biggest problems is the musings that we do. It's about finances or family problems or this or that that might happen in the future. And maybe if we could redirect some of that energy into musing about these higher things, which are a part of our own nature.
Mm-hmm. Again, we come back to that focus. One of the earlier questions talked about mind. Mind is one. Soul is one. And as creative essence, we bring force into a situation and then focus that mind for high or low. And again, there's the earlier article that we used last week, I guess, where there's two types of meditation that we actually sit for, and then that ongoing life's meditation. We do fritter away a lot of mental and physical energy bouncing among themes or topics or what we value that really is transitory. And the process is gradually to turn mind and turn the heart back to eternal, universal, changeless considerations and topics. Yeah?
Follow up on that. I think one of the interesting differences between this article, which will continue next week, and all the others we have this summer, is this one is more like reading a devotional book.
Yes.
But the others are more perhaps intellectual, interesting content. So if we're trying to study this article, how do we study it? If it's devotional, where do we have to study it in order to understand what it's saying?
Ah, when we're using devotional material, and these two articles are the two halves of one big article, really seems to fall into that. You know, there's a difference between reading to decode words to get knowledge and memorizing facts and reading with comprehension where we're looking into the heart and the rendition, we're reading in between the lines of something. And in that latter reading, like when we read poetry, that devotional aspect would be perhaps to read a small portion and then to muse over it or mull over it or stop and reconsider, like we did with the title. You know, a decoder, someone that's head center, is going to read that title, say, okay, I can pronounce those words, I get it, and move on. Instead, what we did this morning as a process is to look into the words and to look into that meaning and to draw from our experience and our commonality to get a richer, fuller, in-depth response to it. Are there other ways that we read devotionally? Did something else occur to somebody else way in the back?
We enjoy in that situation, no matter what the material is, finding a sentence or a phrase or something that grabs us and shakes us, and we know it's an important piece of mind and heart that we need to assimilate. So we print it out and we post it somewhere. And we just recently, the Hermes quote, we always give just one line of it, as above, so
right.
below.
Yeah.
But I had the whole quote hanging in my office at home. And I read it recently and it just took me right back to that process. So sometimes we know people keep devotional books in their pockets and so forth. Just having it available to remind you of what your purpose is.
Mm. And sometimes, you know what, if we go back to that article ending with the pairs of opposites, sometimes in tumult, darkness, pressure, despondency, fear, temptation, tribulation, sometimes in those jangled moments, it helps to have a key phrase, something that has resounded and echoed in our heart and soul. Have that little phrase as an anchor so that it brings us back to a centered position. Yeah.
There is a warning, we think it's by Mr. Judge, that the things that appeal to us, that we're attracted to, we already know.
Yes.
The things that we need to focus on are the things we think, oh, that doesn't matter, or I don't understand that, that doesn't appeal to me. So while we need the encouragement, and it's wonderful to have it in front of us to remind us, we also need to be explorers of the things that don't appeal to us.
Yes, absolutely. And again, there's two different aspects of the same process being discussed here. One is the effort to, when we're living through the personality and the body and the brain and we're jangled, we're centered in the wrong focus. Wrong focus meaning not where we want to be as soul. Sometimes the inspirational familiar reminder acts as an anchor or a centralizing agent. And then at other times the experience is what was just said. The hint, sometimes the alarm clock, the red flag, however, the hammer that hits you in the head, is the experience where something is shocking or it's absolutely, oh, that, and we shoo it away. Instead of being centered and aware, wait a minute, how come I'm shooing that away? Or I've always done it this way. This is, you know, given this experience, I always do blip, 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 and there's that reflex, passionate, automatic behavior. When there's someone else in the vicinity or something else in the vicinity saying, did it work last time? It's two-sided. Yeah.
What I'm getting from this is, I'm going to start by asking a question. There's an old saying that if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one around to hear it,
is there a noise?
Is there a sound?
Yeah.
My answer to that is no, because the very concept of sound comes from man's consciousness. We don't know what a dog calls it. We don't know what a cat calls it, because they can see what we hear in a whole totally different way. But of course, as a scientist, we know it makes some kind of noise. Now, what I'm getting from this, it says that the soul develops like a flower in God's sunlight and unconsciously to the soil in which it grows. Now, God, at some point, we're all become mystics, because where is your true belief base? If you use Christianity as an example, let there be light. So at a certain point, mystically, we have to kind of go, well, I'm going to go with that particular belief that, you know, God said, let there be light. Now, I've been dead before, and I was revived. So I can say, okay, I've crossed a certain mystic boundary, and I can say, well, I communicated with God, so I'm beyond this particular mystical thing that you're talking about. But then it goes back to the same, it goes back to what God, you know. To the Navajos, Raven is the creator. If you study the Kabbalah,
yeah.
Similar, I can't pronounce the name.
You know, it's interesting. I'm going to cut you off a little bit there. In one of the Wadia articles that I was happy to be reading this week, that whole notion, and theosophically we are taught that resident within soul and spirit is this font of universal reality and truth. And as it is reflected, just like white light comes through a prism and then we see the array, or the kaleidoscope mixes up all the colors, as that spirit moves through the human prism and emerges from the other side, we know there's tremendous amounts of varieties of religious expressions. And it was curious to this student that Judge used the word God, because that triggers in many Western minds a personal anthropomorphic being. One of the Wadia articles, he quotes HPB, and this is the quote: "The great master is the term used by Lanus or Chelas to indicate one's higher self, a personal God, an internal, eternal aspect. It is the equivalent of Avalokitesvara and the same as Adi Buddha with the Buddhist occultists, Atman, the self, the higher self with the Brahmins, and Christos with the ancient Gnostics. So as we go out into the world, peopled with a variety of different expressions of what it is to be divine and what it is to try to fit ourselves to the divine will, we will find others who are using other terms for what they can imagine to be that universal, eternal reality, that all-powerful oversoul, if you will. And it will take different symbology. And as we're talking about that with others, the true mystic is going to try to find the commonality of the understanding of spirit and then work with that with the other. Not to do harm to the thinker of the other or to the experiences of the other, but rather to try find common ground and the eternal basis of ethics shared, and to interpret experiences together as best we can. Yeah. Well, the statement was not definitive. It was maybe, but how do I know? And that this would have interpretations for many different ways. In the philosophy, you can do research on after-death states and apparent life-after-life experiences on dreams and deep sleep. Each of us can come into the library and research that from different angles, but all of those experiences, like the ones we have in waking consciousness, the analysis or the assimilation or the interpretation, whatever you want to use, the process is an internal one. It's independent devotion to the pursuit of truth, and not interpretation by somebody else and then categorization. Yeah.
It's interesting that the comment was made that use of the word God here being unusual because it's, we raises up an anthropomorphic conception. That's true for those that follow the dogmatic theology of their particular religion. But it's, you know, these days there's a revival in writings of the Christian mystics.
Mm-hmm.
And when they use the term God or talk about it as the other mystics from other religions, they don't refer to it in anthropomorphic term, but more as the suggestion of a kind of light or presence that they identify with and know within themselves. It's not something
outside. And increasingly, within some very traditional Western Christian churches, small children are being taught more and more and more that God is everywhere and is to be found every. That notion, that Gnostic notion, is now being taught because that's where, frankly, the human mind, the array of spirit is going anyway. And the institution is juggling and trying to follow that. The previous commenter also was referring to symbology among Native Americans for divinity. And what's a very interesting study is to take the Asian teachings of Buddhism and Hinduism and other native kind of Asian religions and compare them to the religious philosophies in the Americas. And the notion of an oversoul, of a creative force that's in all things, a pure pantheism, is very, very akin to the notion of the theosophical oneness of the spirit of all of life. Just a different statement of it. Yeah.
Just that an individual having a mystical experience knows what they know, and no one can interpret it, as you said,
right.
And no one can take it away. It's a
no.
reality. So the individual, it behooves them to pursue it, to understand its real meaning for them. And better, the philosophy says, not to talk about such things because it whittles away the power from us by spreading it that way.
I cannot offer, my apologies, I cannot offer a reference, but here and there throughout the body of literature it are statements that dream interpretation, dreams are to be held secret. It's almost an application of what the Christians follow in the book of Matthew about praying in the closet of one's heart. There are certain things, certain experiences, dreams, certain assimilations, flashes of insight that are meant to be held in silence and sacred to that particular soul. And then as that knowledge becomes assimilated and becomes more a part of the energy of that life, then help can be given from that basis to another, but wordlessly, not spoken aloud. Yeah.
Well, this sounds like the process that one goes through when reading a devotional book. Because the Bhagavad Gita, for instance, it gives great hope. It gives great hope that we are in control. And you know, the voice of the silence. I mean, all of these books offer something that it's very difficult to share with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Comes a personal experience and an understanding as we grow. As our understanding grows, we're able to speak those words that our heart has kept, you know, very sacred.
Mm-hmm. And if the fundamentals are true, if we are from one source, moving cyclically in cause and effect, toward the evolution, the uplift of all in manifestation. As we hold sacred those insights and that mystic experience with the devotional books and other experiences that may come to us medically or whatever, as we begin to ruminate on them to consider or to muse on them as we move through life, we begin to generate energy and force along those lines of consideration. And in so doing, experiences will come to us, words will come to us, we'll hear things in song lyrics, someone will approach us with an insight or a call for help, which is actually an embodiment of what we ourselves need. We begin to generate, you know, the human spirit and mind is a dynamo, and what we place our head and heart on radiates out and in the astral becomes available to those that need it, and also becomes a magnetic drawing in of what is needed in this incarnation for insight and assistance along the way. We don't have to worry about speaking out all the time about what we've experienced or accomplished. We save that maybe for an interview, people that share a particular problem or experience. But in the meantime, we rest assured we're never alone. That process of what we generate and what we attract is ongoing, and the higher and the more consistent we can do it, the more effort we put into it, the more we can rest assured with tremendous hope, as what was just said, tremendous hope that help will come from those who know and can assist. Yeah.
The previous question on how does the person know they met with or spoke with God or heard from God brings up the interesting distinction between a mystic experience and a psychic experience. H.P.B. wrote in one of the articles that most of the denominations and the religions that we have come from an individual who had a psychic experience, believing it was a message from God, and then developed a whole system of theology based on that. So, of course, it's something that cannot be easily answered, but it forces us to be aware of, or try to be aware of, when we're having spiritual experience versus a lower, or just a psychic.
Yeah, that whole idea of intuition, in which we have an instantaneous flash of wisdom or insight into something, the aha moment that some people refer to, can either be spiritual or mystical, or a psychic repercussion or reaction or jazzy embodiment that we mistake as intuition. And if we're musing, if we're aware of those, or at the end of the day when we're reflecting back on the day, we have certain tools that we could use, analogy, allegory, or the ruler, not a rubber ruler, but a real standard ruler of, was that flash universal and true for every single point of life and spirit in manifestation? Or was it just true for and the brain and the body? Did that inspiration or flash or insight, did it bear witness to universal absolute justice? Or was it something that, again, was flavor of the month or a favorite or a pet expression? Was that experience something that I can use in life to uplift my use of all the vehicles and uplift other folks' effort to do the same? Or is that experience more about something that can be used for the selfish and the one-pointed? And if we go through that process, it'll help in weeding out a psychic experience versus a mystic experience. So with that, we will end our meeting and trot off through that door, making the attempt to stay on the True Theosophist path. Have a great week.